This is the MyHeart.net podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Philip Johnson in conjunction with VitalEngine.com. Please welcome your host, Dr. Elaine Bouchard, a cardiology specialist of Birmingham, Alabama, at St. Vincent's Medical Center, part of Ascension.
So welcome to our podcast on pulmonary hypertension. And with me today, very special guest, Jason Guichard, who's an advanced heart failure specialist at Prima Health in South Carolina. And also my very good friend and partner, Dr. Barry Rayburn, who's a heart failure specialist also and specialized not only in advanced heart failure, but also in pulmonary hypertension. He's with our group at Cardiology Specialists of Birmingham. So welcome, gentlemen. And, I think we have a very special topic. I mean, I know it's very dear to you. So I'll start with Jason. Jason, everybody's familiar with hypertension or high blood pressure. So now we're talking about pulmonary hypertension. What is that?
So that's a good question. Happy to be here. So pulmonary hypertension is high blood pressure specifically in the lung artery. So everyone has heard of, regular hypertension or high blood pressure, probably the most common medical issue in the entire world. This is high blood pressure in the body arteries or your systemic arteries. We use a blood pressure cuff to measure that and treat that with various different classes of medications to get your blood pressure down. So your body actually has kind of two circulatory systems, one that goes to your body, that's provided by the left side of the heart. And that's, where hypertension or kind of traditional high blood pressure can be elevated. Now the second circulatory system, if you will, is actually in your lungs. And the right side of the heart or your right ventricle pumps blood from the right ventricle through the pulmonary arteries and into the lungs. Now, just like you can have high blood pressure in your body arteries, you can have high blood pressure in your lung arteries. And that's not just called regular hypertension, it's called pulmonary hypertension. So once you have pulmonary hypertension, so how do you define that? So just like high blood pressure has been defined kind of most recently, abnormal is a systolic blood pressure greater than 130 millimeters of mercury. So defining pulmonary hypertension also has a number associated with it. So recent data from normal patients has shown that a normal mean pulmonary artery pressure or mean pulmonary pressure was 14 millimeters of mercury, plus or minus 3.3 millimeters of mercury. So two standard deviations beyond this number or above the 97.5th percentile would be a mean pulmonary pressure of 20. In addition to that, the 6th World Symposium of Pulmonary Hypertension Task Force looked at a pulmonary vascular resistance of greater than 3. So pulmonary vascular resistance greater than 3, mean pulmonary artery pressure greater than 20 is now defined as elevated or abnormal for patients to be classified as pulmonary hypertension. How do you actually diagnose that, or how do you actually determine if someone can have high blood pressure in the lungs? Probably the most common way of doing that is with an echocardiogram. So most patients are probably first present to their physicians, with kind of classic kind of symptoms of pulmonary hypertension, which actually overlaps with heart failure as well. So shortness of breath, dyspnea on exertion, or getting short-winded when you exert yourself. Sometimes fluid retention, usually those cluster of symptoms will lead to an echocardiogram.
Well, of course, Jason, we'll talk all about this, coming up in a little bit. So let's try to talk a little bit more about this pulmonary hypertension. I know it's been around for quite a while. Way back then, 1951, Dr. Drysdale described 3 cases of pulmonary hypertension. I know when I went in medical school, that was a long time ago in the 70s, we were talking about primary and secondary hypertension. Now, Barry, it's a lot more complicated this time. I guess the WHO classification is really expanded and is described now 5 classes of pulmonary hypertension. Can you help us and describe those classes for us?
Sure, but I've got to correct you just one place, Elaine. You can't ever throw a Hopkins boy out a chance to talk about Osler. So actually, Osler references pulmonary hypertension in his textbook in the 1890s. He refers to a case from Kirschman that was the most extreme example of pulmonary arteriosclerosis in a young man who subsequently died of right heart failure.
Was that in Germany?
Clearly describing pulmonary hypertension in that. So that's actually one of the oldest references that we've got in the literature.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Barry. And that reminds us, you know, he and I come from that Osler source of in medical school at McGill, and Barry Rayburn at Hopkins. Bring some good memory, Barry. Thanks for that.
The five classes, the WHO, World Health Organization, in an effort to try to help us all when we talk about this disease as professionals, talk apples to apples rather than apples to oranges, has developed a classification system that's been updated and modified over the years. And the classification system we use now was most recently modified in about 2018 with some tweaks to the classification system. The disease that most of the time we're talking about and are interested in from the point of view of what Jason described is what is referred to as WHO class one or group one, I should say, pulmonary hypertension. They actually call them groups. And that's true pulmonary arterial hypertension, or to put it another way, it's a disease that lives in the pulmonary blood vessels before the capillaries. And that's an important distinction. So that incorporates several different forms, including a form that we call idiopathic, or what people used to call primary pulmonary hypertension, as well as hereditary forms, and probably even more commonly, forms of pulmonary arterial hypertension that are associated with other disease states. Turns out that there are different flavors of pulmonary hypertension, and they can be caused by something else. So there's a list of these other disease states, some of which are very common, connective tissue diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, some of the other connective tissue diseases, liver disease, and a variety of others. Group two then are numerically more common. These are patients who have a form of pulmonary hypertension related to other kinds of heart failure, more problems located on the left side of the heart, or what Jason described as the body side of the heart. We would actually classify that as pulmonary venous hypertension, or a pulmonary hypertension that occurs after the capillaries. Very important distinction there. Group three pulls in patients who have pulmonary hypertension in the setting of some kind of an underlying lung disease. Interesting thing is patients are very often confused when they come to see a cardiologist about what sounds like a lung-related thing. And one of the things we talk about is that oftentimes in the pure group one disease, the lungs themselves are completely normal. It's the problem in the arteries that's causing their issue. Well, group three, the lungs aren't normal. Group three, these are patients who have some kind of lung disease, and as a result of that, the pressures have gone up. Group four then is a special section reserved for people who have a history of blood clots in their lungs called pulmonary emboli that later on develop a chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. And they're set aside because certain aspects of their treatment are a bit different. And then every good classification system has a wastebasket. And group five, for lack of a better term, is the wastebasket where we put everything else that we don't fully understand yet. And every once in a while, something moves from group five into one of the other groups as we grow to understand it better. But there's some other miscellaneous diseases and problems that cause pulmonary hypertension that are located in group five.
Good. Thanks, Barry. And Jason, you're welcome to kind of jump in whenever you feel like it. Very important. I think today for this podcast, we'll focus on group one of pulmonary arterial hypertension. It looks like we're going to have our hands full. I think it would be worthwhile to have a special podcast maybe on group four, which is this chronic pulmonary emboli or CTEF. And maybe we could invite one of our great surgeons, Dr. McGiffin, because that's actually a special form of pulmonary hypertension that is curable, as most of the others are, I guess we should say, treatable, but don't have quite a solution like in the group four, or CTEF. So Jason, tell, you know, if we kind of focus on the group one, we have patients that have this pulmonary arterial hypertension. What is the pathophysiology? What's wrong with those arteries that the pressure is so high?
So the main kind of pathophysiology around these vessels is the vessels become stiff. They lose their ability to dilate due to kind of various processes, including smooth muscle proliferation, fibrosis. So basically pathologic processes that prevent the arteries from normally doing what they would like to do, relax, constrict when necessary. And as you might imagine, as a pipe becomes very stiff, becomes very tight, and you're trying to push water through those pipes, the pipes can get the pressure can build up very high. So you can imagine these soft kind of compliant arteries that are able to kind of accommodate the ebb and flow of blood through those arteries progressively become stiff. And as that flow continues through the arteries, in order to get the flow through, the pressure has to increase. And that's what you're able to kind of see and detect. As pulmonary hypertension advances, the pressures in the lungs begin to increase.
I heard Dr. Smith at Penn State describe the analogy of a normal pulmonary pressure as a very compliant balloon that we just kind of blow air into, and, you know, for the birthday parties. And the pulmonary arterial hypertension patient, more this kind of long-shaped balloon where you try to blow into and you feel like your eyes are going to pop out. But that's the one that, you know, I think can relate to the pulmonary arterial, you know, hypertension patient. The system where the pressure is very high on the long, skinny artery, such as that balloon. So how common is, you know, we're talking about the group one pulmonary arterial hypertension. Barry, you mentioned the five groups, mentioning the group two and three, I guess, are the most common. What are we talking about in terms of patient population, you know, whether it's a young age or even in the elderly?
It encompasses, group one encompasses a variety of different conditions, as we mentioned. In the most classic sense, the idiopathic and sporadic form of this, what used to be called primary, is a fairly rare disease. It's a disease that has a female preponderance, about 7-to-1 female to male, tends to occur in younger women in their second and third decade of life, although we see that across all decades of life, and we do see it in men as well. But even with that, it's a relatively uncommon condition, accounting for about 4 to 6 cases per million population. When you add in the other forms, particularly the pulmonary hypertension associated with other diseases, those numbers grow quite a bit, because those other diseases tend to be a bit more common in the population, and a subset of those patients with those other diseases also develop pulmonary hypertension. So we start to see a little bit more robust numbers. And it's not uncommon. In the state of Alabama, we have 3 or 4 fairly good-sized clinics that specialize in the treatment of pulmonary hypertension. And I don't think any of us are lacking for business, mostly from within the state. So it is something that we see a fair amount of. The other thing that's happened in the last decade to 2 decades is an increased recognition. So we do see patients now more frequently than we did before. And blessedly, and I hope this is Jason's experience too, we see them earlier in the disease progression than we used to.
What's your experience in South Carolina, Jason?
I think it's probably true of a lot of the southern states. You know, the recognition of rare diseases sometimes can be lacking, you know, in areas that are very rural, that don't have a lot of tertiary care or access to healthcare. Some of these patients really kind of linger and have a delay to diagnosis for some of these rare diseases. Of course, pulmonary hypertension or pulmonary arterial hypertension is one of those. So, you know, in the South, I'm sure, you know, Barry would see that as well. There are a lot of patients that, you know, because of the lack of access, you know, sometimes do come in late. thankfully, in this day and age of media, electronic media, and social media, there has been able to infiltrate some of these areas that had lack of access in order to educate people and be able to connect them with other patients that have had kind of similar or like diagnoses or symptoms, to be able to bring about diagnoses early and allow patients to empower themselves to identify some of these symptoms so they seek out care rather than just kind of linger at home or kind of put things off. So I would say that yes, largely, up to this point, it's been difficult, to get access or identify some of the patients in rural areas, especially in South Carolina. But I do think that that is improving now that we have therapies, we have more ways of getting in touch with people. We have more ways to outreach to both patients and other referring physicians. So I think things are definitely improving.
Well, so that group of patient obviously is the idiopathic, where we don't really, have a identifiable cause. It could be even some family or genetic component to it. We have the connective tissue disease. Barry mentioned lupus and the rheumatoid scleroderma. Very special group, can present that later on in life. We have also the, I would call it the weight loss, type medication, which a lot of them, like Fen-Phen, was taken off the market in, I guess, in the mid-90s. A lot of them causing significant problem with pulmonary arterial hypertension. But still, we see some patients with problem with methamphetamine or other derivative of weight loss. And do you see much of these cases?
I do. I mean, we have some in our clinic that are directly related to methamphetamines. Every once in a while, we'll see a referral related to a chemotherapeutic agent. There are some other drugs that have been implicated, if not necessarily cause and effect, at least a strong association with pulmonary hypertension. Fortunately, those cases, I think, make up a relatively small proportion of what we see.
Same experience, yeah, Jason?
Yes, I would echo what Barry said, with the kind of epidemic we're having with methamphetamines. I think, again, kind of especially in the South, we've actually seen a good bit of patients. We talk about pulmonary arterial hypertension being a rare disease, which it is, and it's true. The methamphetamine epidemic has actually almost doubled, probably the incidence of a rare disease because of, the illicit drug use. We actually have, two patients that have since, stopped methamphetamines, but had a long history in the developed pulmonary hypertension and now are on triple therapy and thankfully doing well. But it is a cause of, pulmonary arterial hypertension that is rising. There's been multiple publications, actually both pulmonary hypertension and heart failure. So as heart failure cardiologists, we're uniquely suited to be managing kind of, some of these sick patients because of their illicit drug use. But yes, it's definitely a rising and growing population of PH patients that, I think we're just now beginning to understand the implications of the methamphetamine use.
Is it reversible if you stop it?
So I would, I don't think that we know just yet. Based on my experience, of course, we're not going to see the people that used, for a year, two, three, or five, and then stopped and then didn't develop pulmonary hypertension. We see the people that developed it. So if I had to kind of use an example of pulmonary embolism, of pulmonary thromboembolism as an example, those patients that get PEs or pulmonary embolism, about a 0.5% to 2% of those patients will develop CTEP or chronic thrombotic pulmonary hypertension. So lots of people get PEs, but only about 0.5% to 2% develop the CTEP, which we'll talk about in a different podcast. So, I would probably liken it to that. Everyone's, lung arteries are a little bit different, probably genetically so. So some people that do methamphetamine, for a year or even less, will develop pulmonary hypertension. But there's probably a large group of patients that, even though you shouldn't take methamphetamine, but probably do it and then don't have any, ill effects with regards to heart failure or pulmonary hypertension. So there's probably other factors that we don't quite understand, whether it's other environmental factors or genetics that play a role in those who do methamphetamine and then ultimately develop pulmonary hypertension.
Right. Barry?
Yeah, I think that that raises an interesting observation. What Jason's alluding to is something that is kind of referred to offhandedly, at least, as the two-hit phenomenon. And it may be at play also with connective tissue diseases or even patients with congenital heart disease who are repaired young at a young age, but we still see a higher incidence later in life of pulmonary hypertension. And as Jason alluded to, there's probably some kind of necessary milieu or underpinning in that patient that makes them susceptible to the trigger of a connective tissue disease or methamphetamine use or congenital heart disease. And that in turn triggers a manifestation that becomes pulmonary arterial hypertension. So that it's an interesting experiment of nature, if you will, to see these patients play out, even though there are many patients, as Jason alluded to, that have the same associated problem, be it substance abuse or other diseases, and don't develop pulmonary hypertension. What's the difference? Well, it may be that they're in a setting that makes them susceptible. And in that is probably a clue that the researchers are digging into to try to help us better understand this disease at a very fundamental level and develop new treatments in an ongoing fashion.
So much still to learn. So how do these patients present, Barry? I mean, let's say someone that has pulmonary hypertension, what are the symptoms and the classic presentations? Some of the patients you see in your clinic, for example.
Well, the ubiquitous, most common symptom across the board is shortness of breath. And in all of the registries reveal and all of the other registries that have been done, far in excess of 80% of the patients typically present with shortness of breath, usually exertional to begin with, although it can become shortness of breath at rest later on in the illness. The other things that we look for are signs of the right side of the heart failing or struggling. So things such as edema in the lower extremities, swelling, early satiety, filling up quickly when you eat, that may be a sign of fluid in the abdomen. Things along those lines can be symptoms early on. Many patients manifest a cough, although that's not uniform. One of the more concerning symptoms, and again, something that we used to see quite a lot of when our patients presented, that now has become a little less common because we're seeing patients a bit earlier, is syncope. Toward advanced stages of the illness, it's not uncommon for patients to pass out while exerting themselves simply because of the inability of the right side of the heart to continue to circulate blood through the very high pressures in the lungs.
So nonspecific. You know, I can't think of so many causes for shortness of breath. It's probably the most generic, you know, symptoms going from, of course, cardiac and pulmonary, even neuro and muscular. And, you know, some other, you know, factors. So very, very nonspecific. Is there actually that shortness of breath, of course, you know, on exertion is usually pretty early on. When it comes at rest, I mean, we're dealing with more severe, severe cases of pulmonary hypertension, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, you allude to the different causes of shortness of breath. As heart failure physicians and cardiologists in general, we see a lot of shortness of breath. One of the distinctions that you can make in a history is generally in pulmonary hypertension, orthopnea will not be nearly as strong of a symptom, nor will PND, the idea of waking up in the middle of the night short of breath, that we see in heart failure. So there tends to be less of a positional component in pulmonary hypertension, at least early on, as compared to heart failure.
Yeah, good point. Jason, you're seeing that patient in the office, and what kind of physical exam do you find normally, or what could the patient be watching for? Barry mentioned some edema in the lower extremities.
Yeah, so the physical exam, of course, is cheap and easy to be able to kind of gather information. So it's always a easy place to start. So a lot of the symptoms, you know, in patients, you know, with mild or moderate pulmonary hypertension, you know, may not really have much physical exam findings. But as they progress and become more severe and more symptomatic, you'll begin to manifest, you know, kind of the classic signs and symptoms, what we call right heart failure. So this is due to the pulmonary hypertension kind of wearing out the right side of the heart and causing it to slowly fail, you'll develop these are what we call right side of heart failure symptoms. So one of those we've talked about already is edema or lower extremity swelling. So this can happen in lots of places. People generally believe or think of your legs, but patients can have swelling in their legs, in their abdomen area, in their arms, in their face. People accumulate fluid and have swelling in lots of different places, and it's not always the same for every patient. Patients can sometimes get very fatigued, lack of appetite, largely because of the fluid accumulating in their internal organs like their stomach and their intestines, which zaps their appetite, can also cause weight loss and fatigue. Some of the exam findings that we find as a healthcare professional, in large liver, sometimes pulsatile, neck veins are distended. On auscultation, when listening to heart sounds, we can hear, right-sided heart failure type sounds, right-sided S3, which is an additional heart sound that you get with volume overload, a systolic murmur of tricuspid regurgitation, which again underscores kind of the severity of the pulmonary hypertension. So there's both findings that patients can see and then findings that physicians can see that indicate kind of the severity and the importance of looking for pulmonary hypertension when we see a patient.
Looks like a lot of the physical exam is a reflection of the state of the right ventricle. And I guess that's going to become, it's probably one of the most important factors, as we'll address a little bit later on. Barry, let's say a patient comes to your office. What is the typical workup that happens there?
So it depends on at what point in the process they're coming in. If you're talking about a patient that presents with a complaint of shortness of breath and not much else has been done, then a careful history, a careful physical examination, as Jason mentioned, this is inexpensive and is crucial, really, to laying the foundation of where to go from there. One of the things that very likely is going to be done early in the process of a patient who is presenting with shortness of breath is an echocardiogram, especially if there's anything in the history or physical examination that points toward the heart or toward the lung vasculature as a potential cause. So an echocardiogram or an ultrasound of the heart is something that's going to happen fairly early on. If it's really a new presentation that hasn't been evaluated before, some very basic laboratory information. We know things like anemia can cause significant shortness of breath, so we'll look at some basic labs and probably also a chest x-ray to make certain that there's not something that's obviously wrong with the lungs themselves.
Let's come back to that echo Doppler, and obviously it's a great tool. I know a good friend of mine, Paul Yock, validated this technique in the 80s, measuring or estimating, I should say, the non-invasively, the pulmonary artery pressure, so-called RVSP, derived from the right ventricular systolic pressure. Tell us some of the pitfalls that we encounter, because a lot of times the patient get their echo report and they see this RVSP. Oh my God, it's like measuring 45 or 60, severe pulmonary pressure. Tell us a little bit more about those echo findings.
Well, the physics behind it is irrefutable. And if Jason's experience is anything like mine, if we have a conversation with one of our diehard echo colleagues, they love to tell us that due to technical issues, the echo could possibly underestimate the RV systolic pressure, but it should never overestimate the RV systolic pressure. But in clinical practice, we see that literally all the time. The problem is number one, the technique of obtaining these numbers is very important. The more experience the technician has in general, the more experience they have specifically looking at this parameter, and the more amenable the patient's body type is to getting a good study, all factor into it. But even if all of those things are perfect, there are many, many assumptions that are built in. And if any one of those assumptions is off, that can throw the numbers off fairly significantly.
Since my world originally was the equal world, that formula was pretty simple, actually. It was you took the velocity across the the red blood cell across the tricuspid valve, squared it, which is always which is a problem if you have a wrong measurement. Then you multiply it times four, so you multiply that error even more, you know. And then you add the so-called right atrial pressure, which Paul originally described it as looking at the neck veins, but most technicians now, they just record the size and the movement of the inferior vena cava, the IVC. Half the time, you can't even see the IVC on the echo, and they just estimate, they just almost pick a number. Really problematic. And to be careful when a patient sees that, it does not necessarily mean that they have, you know, pulmonary arterial hypertension. If they see a higher reading there, it could be erroneous. Jason, you know, Barry mentioned chest X-rays. In the labs, of course, to rule out other causes. Do you do other kind of pulmonary tests, or do you do VQ scan or CTs, or what else do we do in your practice?
Yes, so all of those, like Barry suggested, you know, the blood test and immunologic testing. Electrocardiograms, ECG, as well as the echo as well, chest X-ray, abdominal ultrasound. We do that sometimes in, you know, in patients that, you know, may have, you know, liver disease or that sort of thing. VQ scan is a very sensitive, you know, marker to rule out CTEP or to make sure that they don't have any pulmonary embolisms that could be contributing. High-res CT scan to look at the lung parenchyma itself to make sure there's no lung disease, you know, emphysema, COPD, ILD, those types of things that could be causing, you know, hypoxia and pulmonary hypertension. PFTs can also pick that up as well. Probably another important thing is making sure everyone has an updated sleep study. I think if someone is within the realm or within the possibilities of pulmonary hypertension, whether they meet that kind of box or not of sleep apnea, you know, kind of your overweight, out of shape type individual, even thin people can have sleep apnea. Sometimes you can be very surprised. So that's often something that I think about as well as making sure they have a sleep study or at least having that ruled out. And then in select patients, genetic testing as well. We've kind of briefly talked about that. So if you have a family member that's had pulmonary hypertension yourself and you're beginning to develop symptoms, you know, genetic testing can sometimes be helpful. But all of those are good. But ultimately, leading up to, you know, diagnosing the disease itself, you know, would be the right heart cath. Right. I'll just stop there. I don't know if that's where you were going or not.
Yeah, that's pretty much where we're headed. On the CT, do you pay much attention to the size of the pulmonary arteries and how they compare to the aorta? Or is there, you know, there's too much of a...
That's a great question. You know, you often see that a lot on, you know, CTs and even chest X-rays. You know, the radiologist will comment on the size of pulmonary arteries. You know, to my knowledge, you know, Barry can correct me if I'm wrong, you know, none of the risk scores or diagnosis algorithms or anything, you know, suggest pulmonary artery size is something that we look at. For me, it's just kind of additive information. It kind of tells me that, number one, that the pulmonary tension is, you know, probably severe, number one. And then number two, it's probably been a chronic process. You know, your pulmonary arteries won't get large overnight. You know, it's a, you know, they slowly dilate over an extended period of time. So for me, it doesn't really necessarily change management or the diagnosis. It just kind of adds additional information for me that, you know, hey, this person's probably had pulmonary hypertension for a while and we need to do something about it to look into it further.
I guess also it gives us a good picture of what the right ventricle is doing, you know, whether the right ventricle is hypertrophy or the muscle walls are thicker or very dilated, even pushing, you know, onto the septum. So let's talk about this right heart cath. I mean, Barry, let's say you take, you've seen a patient in the clinic, PA pressure estimated maybe around 50, 60, the right ventricle is enlarged. You want to explore some more, you know, what, you take this patient into the cardiac catheterization and you want to do a right heart cath. How do you do that? What happens to the patient in the cath lab and what should they expect? And
sure.
What do you measure?
So a right heart catheterization is distinctly different from what most people think of as a heart cath. When we talk about a heart cath in generic terms, most of the time we're talking about an arteriogram, where we're going in with catheters into an artery to look at the arteries that feed the heart muscle, typically by squirting dye down them for the purpose of finding blockages and possibly placing stents and so on and so forth. This is very different than that. A right heart catheterization is fundamentally looking at the pressures and flows in the various chambers of the heart and is done, first of all, without contrast, typically. Second of all, we access a vein rather than an artery. Both of those tend to lower the risk of the procedure quite a bit. Not that catheterization is a terribly risky procedure to begin with, but right heart catheterization even less so. And then finally, the whole focus of the right heart catheterization is basically to make measurements. We're making physiologic measurements of the pressures and flows in various chambers of the heart. We're sampling blood, measuring oxygen levels. All of this is done with the guidance as necessary of X-ray or just the hemodynamic tracings themselves, the tracings of the pressure readings. And it gives us a picture, not only a direct measurement of this lung pressure that we're talking about, but it gives us a lot of information to help us sort out, is this group one? Is this group two? Is it a combination of those in some way? What's the prognosis or what state is the patient in now in terms of how well is the heart handling these high pressures? Do we see evidence that the right side of the heart is struggling or failing already? So it's a wealth of information. And I think at this point, it's important to mention the diagnosis of pulmonary arterial hypertension simply cannot be made without a right heart catheterization. It's not proper to make it on the basis of an echocardiogram alone. So this is a necessary step in the evolution of trying to help diagnose the patient.
Right. Jason, do you do other things like a vasodilator, challenge in the cath lab or fluid challenge?
Yes. So there are, kind of various maneuvers that you can do, in the cath lab when trying to kind of tease out pulmonary hypertension. I often tell my patients, we go in there for the right heart cath, to kind of get baseline measurements. But sometimes there are situations where, we find things or if our clinical suspicion is still very high, going ahead and doing additional maneuvers, what I call them, or testing, can be important to kind of tease away, a patient's symptoms. So one of those is exercise. That is one way, especially if patients, get dyspnea with exertion. So shortness of breath when they exert themselves, everything we've talked about at this point, including echocardiogram, is done at rest. But you have patients tell you that, hey doc, when I'm going up a hill or going up an incline, that's when I get short-winded. So sometimes it's good to, kind of mimic that situation so you can actually see what's going on inside the heart and lungs while that patient is having their symptoms. So that's why the exercise can be very important. So a couple other maneuvers. One of those is, what we call fluid loading or a fluid challenge to see how the patient's pulmonary pressures is, and more specifically, their pulmonary capillary wedge pressure can change with kind of rapid fluid loading. So what does it look like? So, for our patients, we have them have the rest right heart cath. So everything lying flat on the cath lab table. We get our initial measurements. And at that point, what we do is we administer 500 milliliters of normal saline over 5 minutes. So it's kind of a rapid infusion of normal saline. And then we repeat all of the measurements that we just took. And an abnormal, or what we believe to be an abnormal response to fluid challenge would be a pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. So one of the pressures in your heart, or one of the pressures that we're able to get with the right heart cath that kind of is a surrogate for the left-sided heart pressures. If it rises to greater than 18, there's been studies that have shown that that would be an abnormal response. So this maneuver can kind of disclose or suggest that maybe someone has what we call underlying diastolic dysfunction. So their left side of the heart can't accommodate because it's stiff, a rapid infusion of fluids. So it could signal some sort of myopathic process. And this, again, isn't necessarily your WHO group 1 pulmonary hypertension. This would make you lean towards the WHO group 2 or the pulmonary hypertension due to left-sided heart disease. So that would be, you know, exercise and fluid are kind of two maneuvers that we can do in the cath lab to kind of tease out what could be causing a patient's shortness of breath or evaluate the pulmonary hypertension further.
Well, no, I think it's great. I was wanting to know, how do you do the also the vasodilator?
So yes, vasoreactivity testing and pulmonary hypertension is very important. So when a patient is confirmed to have what we call the WHO group 1 or the pulmonary arterial hypertension, you know, based on right heart cath, when a patient is confirmed to have that in an otherwise negative evaluation, then the vasoreactivity testing can be appropriate to kind of initially determine what would be best to treat the patient. So how do we do that? So again, in the cath lab, vasoreactive testing involves the administration of short-acting vasodilators, followed by the measurement of the hemodynamic response, you know, via the right heart cath. So there's a few different agents that are used. I can briefly talk about kind of the three main ones and then what we use. So the agents commonly used for vasoreactivity testing include inhaled nitric oxide is one, IV epoprostenol, which is a prostacycline, is another one, and then adenosine, which is often used in the cath lab for a variety of kind of different procedures. So those are the three main vasodilator agents used for reactivity testing. We personally, at our center, we use inhaled nitric oxide. It is a little bit more expensive than the other two, but it's a little bit more cleaner. It has a very kind of rapid onset and rapid decline. And it's probably one of the more common ones used. So it's administered inhaled. So anywhere from 10 to 80 parts per million. So at the beginning of the test, your physician will put on a little mask, probably with the help of a respiratory therapist, and slowly dial up that nitric oxide. It's very selective for the pulmonary vasculature, which is what we're trying to evaluate, with minimal systemic effects, which is what we're trying to avoid. And we believe is kind of better tolerated than the IV agents, you know, the epoprostenol or adenosine. So we usually start at about 20 parts per million for about 5 minutes. And then we kind of slowly increase by about between 10 and 20 parts per million. And again, for every 5 minutes. And the test is considered positive, so when do we stop? So this is when we know that a test is positive. If the mean pulmonary artery pressure decreases by at least 10 millimeters of mercury to a value less than 40, and with an increased or unchanged cardiac output, and a minimally reduced or unchanged systemic blood pressure, those would be classified as a positive test. So there's lots of ifs. But if you meet all of those criteria, then you would be considered positive vasoreactivity testing. And that would qualify you for a special group of medications, in that case, that you would avoid some of these expensive new medicines and do well longevity-wise and mortality-wise.
So you don't have to kind of reach a certain level of mean pulmonary arterial pressure. If you just kind of have a lowering effect of the nitrous oxide, for example, that is greater or equal to 10 millimeters mercury, you do qualify as a responder to vasodilator.
That's correct. So at least a decrease of 10, an absolute number less than 10, and a value mean less than 40. And an increased or unchanged cardiac output would be, you know, positive vasoreactivity testing. Yeah.
So already in the cath lab, you can have the idea of a patient that is a responder or non-responder. But if he is a responder, usually it's a better prognosis, isn't it?
Yep, that's largely believed to be true. And these would be candidates for calcium channel blocker therapy. So either your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like amlodipine Orfalodipine or nifedipine, or in some cases, diltiazem as well. So this is a favorable, positive prognosis, because these patients, you know, their arteries react to these medicines, would necessarily avoid, you know, some of the other medications, that we'll talk about shortly. Now, I will say that you're talking, so as a little caveat, and we've kind of described this already, this is a rare disease, right? We've already talked about that, about, you know, now, even within that very rare disease, positive vasoreactivity testing is very rare within this very rare disease. So we are talking about a very, very small patient population. I often like to say that this is really kind of more board material than actually practical material. As you know, we all have been, you know, in and out of the University of Alabama, Birmingham, which has a very large pulmonary hypertension clinic, which I was, you know, trained at and Barry worked at. And even within this very large patient population of pulmonary hypertension, there were only really a handful of patients that were on these calcium channel blockers. So you're talking about an incredibly high volume center that deals with a lot of referrals and a lot of patients. And even them, they had a very small population of people that met, you know, this criteria. So it's fun to talk about and it's easy to test on our boards and our tests, but practically speaking, this is not something you see a whole lot, but when you do, it's very exciting.
Certainly a cheaper medication. They work very well. Do they remain responder for a long time or just?
So not necessarily. So some of the, if we want to kind of dive into this a little bit deeper. So there's a couple problems, you know, with these medicines. Number one, we talk about calcium channel blockers, but it's actually high dose calcium channel blockers. For amlodipine, you know, the typical dose that we use in patients is about 5 to 10 milligrams. For pulmonary hypertension patients, it's anywhere from 20 to 40 a day. So as you might imagine, you know, hypotension, especially if this is a young female or very high dose diltiazem, can be an issue. So sometimes these medications are just not very well tolerated. And then the longevity of the response is not always guaranteed. So in this rare disease with this rare patients that are, you know, have a positive vasoreactivity testing, not even all of them will be able to tolerate the therapy or, you know, have it be long lasting. So there are, you know, lots of ifs, you know, with regards to the testing and the therapy. But for those very few patients where this does work and they're able to stay on the medications, it can provide them with a great benefit without having to be on additional medicines that can be very costly.
Barry, before we wrap up this session, I'd like to see maybe if you could mention briefly, once you get all this data, what kind of factors do you look at to evaluate the risk and the prognosis of a patient, and particularly in reference to, you know, is it just a matter of how high their pulmonary arterial, you know, pressure is and or how the right ventricle is handling it? What kind of factor do you use and in your equation to establish their prognosis?
Well, it's a really important question, Elaine, not only for this initial evaluation, but part of the guidelines of managing are a continual reevaluation of the patient's prognosis and various factors to help you determine when it's time to move to an additional therapy or change your therapeutic approach. So the first, we always start with the patient, and you know, we're all classically trained. You always go back to the history and physical, and there are very important elements there. The simplest of which is what's referred to as the functional class. So we've been talking about WHO groups to distinguish the different types of pulmonary hypertension. There's also a term WHO class, which is a functional classification very similar to what we're all familiar with physician-wise as the New York Heart Association functional class, just applied to this pulmonary hypertension population. And from a simple perspective, just think of it as a quick overview of how sick a patient is. And it ranges from class one, patients who have very minimal limitation of their daily activities, through class four, which are patients who are symptomatic at rest, and everything in between. So how the patient's doing, how far they can walk, what they're able to do, what their limitations are, that plays a role. We formalize that a little bit in the pulmonary hypertension community with something called the six-minute walk test. The six-minute walk test is a test that can be easily administered in the office. We do it routinely. Basically, in your office, you have a measured hallway or a marked out distance where patients start walking, just walking, for 6 minutes. Stopwatch is running. The stopwatch doesn't stop. The patient can stop if they need to. And you simply measure how far in meters the patient walks in a 6 minute period. That, it turns out, especially tracking that over time, also provides some information. Now, when it comes to the initial evaluation with the right heart catheterization or looking at other data, such as the echocardiogram, the data get very interesting because they start to tell us a little bit about the pathophysiology of the disease. And it makes sense. This is a disease of pulmonary pressure problems, that the higher the pressure, the worse the disease. Turns out it's not as simple as that. And it's actually a problem of pulmonary resistance more than it's a problem of pulmonary pressure. Dr. Simoneau, a French pulmonary hypertension expert who's been in this field for a very long time, published the results of a database many years ago that initially drew a real skeptical response from the pulmonary hypertension community, because one of the findings in his database analysis was that patients with a lower pulmonary arterial mean pressure actually had a worse prognosis. And honestly, people thought he had messed up his math, something as simple as that. But it was a much more elegant explanation that as patients progress through their disease states, there comes a point, even as the resistance continues to rise, where the right ventricle, which is the pump pushing blood into that or against that resistance, starts to fail so significantly that the cardiac output, the amount of blood being pumped, starts to drop rather precipitously. And with that drop, the pulmonary mean pressure actually goes down. So if you're looking at a patient at 2 points in time, and it looks like the pulmonary arterial pressure has gotten better, that's not the whole story. You have to know what the cardiac output has done, which goes back to our discussion of echo alone versus right heart catheterization, giving you that additional information on in terms of what's happening. And the bottom line, to come back to your original question, is in the right heart catheterization, PA pressure is a less effective measure of prognosis than is the cardiac output or the right atrial pressure, both of which are markers of the health of the right ventricle. It's the health of the right ventricle that either wins or loses the day. And as cardiologists, what Jason and I are struggling to do with a patient is to preserve their right ventricular function.
Well, that's great. I think it'll be a good time to close this session. Such an interesting topic. Next podcast, we'll discuss the treatment and how we actually accomplish the preservation of the right ventricular function and improve on the prognosis of these patients. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thanks, Barry. Thanks, Jason. We'll see each other next week.
To learn more from our team of cardiologists, please visit us at myheart.net. You can also follow us on social media by searching myheart.net on Facebook and Twitter. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss our next episode.